Prepare to be astonished!
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening, happy holidays, and Merry Christmas. It's just a few days away now.
So I better start my shopping.
You better, yes. I mean, there's always a few stores that are open on Christmas Eve, but if Santa's not coming to your house, you need to...
Well, the gift shop at the Astoria Column is open, the gift shop at the Carriage House Visitor Center, at the Film Museum, at the Heritage Museum, they're all open, so your Christmas shopping there. You could do all your Christmas shopping.
Ooh,
there.
And you could even buy memberships for the year to give away, because those are really well priced.
Yeah.
And they come with free gifts or tickets to bring guests as well, so.
Yeah, and when you're buying your Historical Society membership, you go up to the Column and buy your 2026 parking pass just $5.
For $5.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
$5, you go up there every day.
It is the best price. What, it went from because didn't it just go from 1 to 5? Or was there...
Before I got involved. So it was a while ago. I think it was $2 and then it went to 5.
Okay. But it's like, still, people, it's for the whole year.
Well, and you know what else? I don't think people paid attention so much, but $1 of that 5 goes directly to the City of Astoria Parks Department.
Okay. That's great.
And then $1 of that 5 also goes into a special preservation fund. So the next time we have to totally redo the column like we did, 10 years ago for $1.3 million, we've got a little bit of money put aside for it.
Probably not $1.3 million.
Not yet.
Not yet.
We're working on it.
I mean, yes.
So maybe you should buy 2 passes.
Ooh, okay. 2 passes and then, yes. Okay. So we got all that. We have a special guest here, Sheila Rowley. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. The week of Christmas. You know, I think I reached out to you like years ago, several years ago, and I was like, can I have you as a guest? And you're like, no, I'm too busy. She retires and then she goes back to work. So I had to wait like another year. She doesn't even remember. She's looking at me. But I did. I remember reaching out to you. It was a long time ago. And so... I keep on my people that I want to have on the show.
You do. You're relentless.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, hopefully you'll still be happy in about 28 minutes.
Yeah.
Well, everybody has a good time when they're here.
Yes,
I think. So we do have tea and plum pudding still going on, 26th through the 30th.
Yep. Great activity day after Christmas. Get those people and kids out of your house. Send them to the museum.
Somebody's making plans.
Yes.
That's funny.
Yes, the Quila family is booked for the 26th.
Excellent.
Yeah, done.
You are almost like you're about to say what time so everybody else could join and see.
Well, it's 1 to 4, so yes. You could probably figure out exactly when I booked it.
But you're not going.
But I'm not going. Nope. So, I said my husband and kids.
That's right.
Yep.
All right. Shall we get right to the history highlights? Because I think we have a lot to talk about here.
Yes.
All right. So these are things that happen tomorrow. As always, icebreakers or conversation as you've got family in town. December 22nd. Yep. These are things that happen on December 22nd. 1864. General Sherman presents President Lincoln with the city of Savannah, Georgia as a Christmas present. Civil War.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. I got you, Savannah. All right, 1956. Oh, I was going to quiz you on what year you would have guessed, but it's too late now.
1956.
Both know it happened in 1956. The first gorilla is born in captivity.
Oh, yeah. No, I would not have guessed.
That seems so late to me.
It does.
It seems like it should have. I mean, we've had zoos forever, but it was Colo at the Columbus Zoo in Ohio.
And that's for the world?
Yes. That's what.
Interesting.
I saw it on the internet, so it must be true.
Yes.
In captivity.
Okay. So. True. Yeah. And documented too, of course.
See, that's the part. Probably undocumented somewhere else. All right.
Sure.
1984. And I'm curious whether you're aware of this at all or if it was just really like in a New York thing. 1984, Bernard Goetz shoots 4 youths on the subway in New York City. Do you remember this at all? Or was it strictly a Northeast thing?
I don't remember.
I do remember.
Do you remember? Okay. Yeah, he was approached by 4 African. He was on the subway. He's like a 40-year-old tech kind of guy, white guy. But he felt threatened by 4 African-American youths that came up to him. And they asked him for money, and he felt like he was being robbed, and he shot them all.
And killed them?
He did not kill any of them, but he did. I think one was actually in a wheelchair after that.
Oh.
And that was part of it, that he shot one guy a second time, saying, "You don't look so bad," and shot him again.
Oh.
But I think he got pretty much off, didn't he? Like maybe six months probation or something.
But I'm sure it wasn't a very equitable
decision process.
No. Yes. But there is a huge debate in the whole Northeast about, well, he was feeling threatened, and is that legitimate or not? And were they robbing him? Were they not? And right. And of course, the race came into it. But it was a huge thing for like 4 or 5 years.
Well, sure.
All right. 1993, Philadelphia, the first major Hollywood movie about AIDS, opens in theaters.
Very good movie.
It's
yeah.
a good movie.
Yeah. Yeah, tough to watch, but of course, you know, Tom Hanks just nails it.
Annoyed that it was not filmed in Oregon, but I guess Philadelphia, they kind of had to go to Philadelphia.
Yes.
So we do care, even though it was an Oregon film. 2001, the world's first cloned cat is born in a biomedical lab in Texas. They named it CC for copycat.
No.
Yes.
Did they really?
They did. Thank you. I'm glad that made you laugh too, because it made me laugh when I read it. So copycat actually lives for 18 years.
Oh, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Clone cat.
Okay.
2001.
Interesting. Yeah, just barely making history there.
Okay. And our history highlight today, I think had the most impact on history. And I was tempted to make it Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. But then I saw 1882. The first string of Christmas tree lights is created by Thomas Edison.
Oh.
I did a deeper dive, and of course, it really wasn't Thomas Edison. It was a guy that worked for him.
Okay.
Named Edward Hibbert Johnson is the one that actually came up with the idea and made it. But Christmas tree lights.
Yeah. They're like, what else can we do with this? Can we make any more money?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And lights everywhere all of a sudden.
Genius. So. And indoors and outdoors. Yeah. Well, and much safer than candles.
And that's what prompted it.
Right.
Yeah.
So dangerous. So, I mean,
the guy had actually been working on it for a few years.
Okay.
But anyway, that's the thing.
Yeah,
I think had the most impact on history. Did I miss anything or do you disagree?
No, you did fine.
Fine.
Just fine. We're bringing in the Quila kids next week. So, you know, I mean, you got to up your game a little bit.
I will have to up again my game.
Alma at least will, you know. She'll be ready to go back and forth with you on whether it's history or not.
That's right.
Yes. But we have our guest. So Sheila Rowley is here.
But because
yes, how many different ways can I say it?
I was going to save you by jumping in, but
yes.
you kept going too far. I was going to say right before we went on the air.
I said it
I
right.
love how you tell people how to say it.
Yeah.
You say
rock and Rowley.
Rock and Rowley. I love that. It kind of makes me wish my last name was that so I could start saying that. It's a good phrase.
Okay.
All right.
So retired from Seaside School District as the superintendent, among other things. But we want to go back farther.
Okay.
So tell us where you grew up.
I grew up in Seattle, Washington, born and raised there, and lived there the first half of my life. And then my husband had a job opportunity to come down to the Oregon coast. And I said I would try it for a year. I came kicking and screaming from my hometown. And that was in 1988, and I am still here. So I think what won me over is that I had the opportunity for a job once I got here. And my colleagues in the Seaside School District were so gracious and welcoming. It was once you get tied into the right tribe, then you don't want to leave. And I didn't anticipate that I would be in the district for over 30 years, but it was a wonderful opportunity and, you know, no regrets.
So what did you start out teaching?
I was a biology teacher.
I thought that.
And I think a lot of people choose their life's path based on a teacher. And I never really thought about being a biology teacher until I had one that was such an amazing influence on my life. And she taught just regular biology and advanced biology and marine biology. And when I was a senior in high school, she was bound and determined that her marine biology students would have an opportunity to go out on the Calypso, which was docked for a while at the University of Washington for some research. And I had gone to an all-girls Catholic school. So it's a bunch of 18-year-old girls in uniforms climbing around the Calypso. But you know, those are the kinds of moments that really make an impression.
So I love that. And talk about your relationship with that teacher. Did you feel like this teacher was a mentor, or did you just feel like, oh, this is a really good teacher? I mean, did you ever talk, and did they ever give you career advice or tell you where you should go to school or what you could do with a degree? Or was it just, wow, you were a really great teacher?
I think it was, I wasn't as sophisticated as what you're describing. I think I just knew she was a really great teacher, but she was a first year teacher when I was a sophomore. And so she wasn't very much older than I was. And so I had her, again, her rookie year, and then the next year, I think it was chemistry, and then the next year we went into advanced biology, and she was so engaging. She had a great sense of humor, and just based on, again, the incident with the Calypso, she was an advocate for finding exciting and engaging things for us to do. I mean, field trips, you know, going all the way out to Cape Alava, which is the far tip of the Washington coast to, you know, see sea life. She was not a read the book, fill out the worksheet kind of people. She was very interactive, very lab-based, project-based. And I think that really speaks to a lot of students, and that they can see and do real things when they're in a classroom. So I don't know that I could have articulated that, you know, back then, but I, you know, in hindsight and my own experience in education, I'm able to see a better perspective. And a couple of years ago was my 50th high school reunion. And we invited some of our teachers who were still living, because they would have had to have been young teachers. And I had the amazing honor to tell her she changed my life.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's kind of...
Oh, my gosh.
How did she react?
We both cried.
Oh.
So, no, it was just when you realize you've had an impact on a young person, it's pretty exciting.
But that long ago, too, because that's the start of her career.
Mm-hmm.
And then she had to wait till your 50th to hear that. I mean, there's that, too, right? That evolution of waiting while that person lives out their career, and to be able to tell her, too. And I became, you know, I taught all these years and I became superintendent. And I mean, what was her reaction? Just, I mean.
Well, I think she was really surprised in that she said no one had ever told her that before. And I thought, wow, well, I'm sure there's other students who would have said the same thing. You know, some people, they rise to the top. And again, it's because they're there to serve kids and to allow them the opportunity to experience education in a very, you know, expanded way. Mm-hmm. So, but it's just the rare thing is that I had the opportunity to actually be in her presence and tell her.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love that. Was there any discussion from this teacher, or even those first 3 years, or maybe when you're going to college, of women in science?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a man's world. What are you doing? You can't do science.
Right.
I mean, did you have to overcome that?
No.
Did you face that at all?
I don't remember really. Well, I can't say that. So I went to University of Washington, and I actually graduated in fisheries biology, and I did not go into teaching until I was in my mid-30s. And my first job was working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they were hoping to hire women with fisheries degrees because that was really when, you know, there was some push to allow women to have some equal status. And no one was unkind to me, but was I, you know, seen as a really full-fledged member of the crew? I'm not sure. I mean, I, you know, was young and 22 and was going to just be pushy and do what I needed to do. And then I was sometimes put in a position if we were doing some, you know, statistical work out in the field, I'd always be the one that got handed the clipboard to write down the numbers, you know, so just, you know, nothing, you know, high level harassment, but just subtle, you know, well,
yeah,
give the girl the clipboard. You know, again, no one articulated that, but it was pretty obvious.
Right.
But beyond that, I mean, certainly in my career in the Seaside School District, I had the opportunity to be the first female principal at Seaside High School and the first female superintendent. And you know, you stand on the shoulders of those before you. And I never had any concerns that I wasn't validated in that field, which, again, was in heavily a male-focused field. And when I became superintendent in Seaside, there's 199 districts in the state. I think there was fewer than 10.
So, oh my goodness.
I'm impressed there were 10.
Yeah, now it's about 30-40% are women. That's amazing. Yeah.
But even so, I mean, that astounds me in an industry or a job profession that's still, I would say, primarily women, right? Or is it not?
Well, it depends on the grade level.
Okay.
There's more women in the earlier years. And then when you get into high school, you know, there's certainly sometimes even more men than women.
That's what evens it out a little.
Mm-hmm. But at one point in Seaside, we got to the point where all the principals were women for a couple of years. Yeah.
So I'm interested that you didn't go into teaching right away. So what led you to go into teaching later?
Well, I really enjoyed fisheries biology and being out in the wild, but I had gotten married right out of school, and my husband was a fisheries biologist, and we decided we'd have some kids, and we had 3 kids in 4.5 years.
Oh my gosh!
But that was our intention. I mean, I wanted to have kids young, and if we were going to have them, I just wanted to go boom, 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 and I stayed home, and you know, to have 3 kids under kindergarten. First of all, I really enjoyed it. You know, I have no regrets about taking that time out. But I didn't want to go back into the type of work that I'd done where you had maybe 2 or 3 weeks of vacation. And I had a number of friends who had become teachers. And that had never been something I had aspired to. And I think they won me over with the you get summers off mentality. And I said, oh, that sounds like a good idea, and I could do that for a while. And my first opportunity to step into a classroom, which is before student teaching, before the classes, they bring you in for 3 weeks to see if you want to do it. Day one, hour one, I'm sitting there going, why did I not always know this was what I was supposed to do?
Oh.
So.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was. It was almost it was a seminal moment in my life of just like, holy smokes, how did it take me so long? So,
and what was that environment? What grade level or what?
Junior high.
Oh,
even more.
7, 8, 9.
Yeah.
And the teacher that I was working under gave me a lot of free rein and allowed me to teach classes maybe a little earlier than some folks. And, you know, he was always there. And, you know, that age kids, I love them. But they're just smart, Alex. But I had been raised in a big family with lots of siblings, and we were much a smart Alex too. And I found out that they were my people. I got their jokes, and so I spent a little bit of time in every level, K-12, but that's where I spent most of my time.
I also feel like too. I mean, you did survive like living on a boat too, with people like slinging fish and fish guts. So what were junior high kids going to do to you?
That's
like,
right.
Like, yeah. You know. Well, and they're the it's the age group that parents will come and say they're driving me crazy. They're pulling their hair out. Well, that's because you're their parents. But they just have to kind of go through that. It's part of their development and becoming independent. But they aren't that way with their teachers. So.
That's what I always say, that's why we have middle school and junior high, is to segregate them. they're the worst.
We had another guest on here a couple months ago, Bree Phillips, who also went into teaching, and she did like 3 weeks at a junior high, and she switched her major like on the last day of it and was like, I'm never doing that again in my life.
But then they also have her teaching sex education.
They did.
Which is horrible. That's
her student teaching.
At age 18 or 19.
Yes. Yeah, I spent 12 years teaching at that level. So
wow, good for you.
Yeah, and when I was in Seaside, my kids went through school, health and science were together, and I also had to teach sex education. And all 3 of my children absolutely refused to be in the classroom for that week. So I let them go to the library. It's like, you are not talking about this stuff in front of my friends.
Yeah, right. This is so-and-so's mom. Yeah.
So before we dive deeper into teaching and education, I do want to revisit just really quickly your career before that. What kinds of studies were you doing? What kinds of, that you're out in the field and you're being handed the clipboard, but what are the projects?
Well, University of Washington has its own fish hatchery and has for a long time. And in the, in the 70s and the 80s, we really were heavily reliant on hatcheries. And I know there's a lot of controversy about that now, but there had been so much habitat destruction without hatcheries, we would have, you know,
depleted.
It would have
stocks. Yeah.
So there was a lot of work around that, around nutrition for fish, to grow them in a healthy way. You know, we just did a lot of capturing the baby fish and weighing them and measuring them and making sure they were thriving. And then occasionally there'd be field work. And, you know, honestly, it's been so long, I can't even remember exactly what we did other than water quality. You know, we were doing water quality things.
Okay.
And
well, since you said fish, I have to ask my stupid question that shows that I'm not the journalist that Alana is. What's your favorite fish?
To eat.
To eat.
Ankarinka Shabasha, which is also known as Chinook salmon.
Okay.
And part of that Catholic school thing is I had to take 4 years of Latin, or I had the opportunity to take 4 years of Latin.
You had the opportunity.
Opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, everybody had to take a foreign language. Yes. The opportunity was given by my dad about which language I would be taking. But as a biology student,
oh, that's phenomenal. True.
Yeah.
So did you teach biology? You taught science. You said science and sex ed.
Well, I taught a life science.
Okay.
Did some botany, so it was pretty generic, general science in the field of biology.
Yes. Okay.
Tell them about the change in education from when you started to when you retired. The good and the bad.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think the things that come up the most to me are when No Child Left Behind came along, which was in many ways a challenging law to work with, but in others it was absolutely what needed to happen. And I think there was always some level of standardized testing, and schools would be able to say, oh yeah, we have these phenomenal outcomes. But what No Child Left Behind did is it broke down those statistics in schools to various groups of kids. So if you're saying, oh, this school has got really low scores and this one's got really high scores, well, then you look at the demographics. You look at the demographics of economics, of race, of gender. And you couldn't take all those groups and not, you know, and roll them into one bunch and have really meaningful data. And I think that's when we started to recognize that we need to do a better job in education to make sure that truly no child is left behind, and that there is a need to provide different kinds of support for kids who have different needs, that we really needed to be committed and diligent with that. And so that's, I think that was probably the most monumental thing that has happened in my own career. And again, I think standardized testing can kind of have a bad vibe for a lot of people. And I think at times it has been overdone and made the only measure of a kid's success. So I think it's become more nuanced now, but The state of Oregon has really struggled with its reading scores statewide, and it's not one of the more forefront states in the country. And
we're like at the very bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I hate to say it out loud, but that's true. Yeah, and you know, you have to have the appropriate curriculum, you have to have the appropriate pedagogy, and so it's a dynamic field, really. You can't just say, well, we've got these books, we've got these kids, let's go for it. And it's there's a lot of things to consider to do what is in the best interest of all of our children.
And where do you think that data is, though, in placing us at the bottom? Because surely, I mean, we can compare ourselves to some other states that just do really low, like in the South, on so many tests, right? And so many. So how do we, I mean, where does that?
Well, I'll tell you, the South is rocking it. Arkansas.
So,
Oklahoma, their scores wipe us off the map. And so that is it used to be a conception that people had that the, you know, poor people in the South, and no longer true. they have better systems that we should be emulating. And I can't articulate what they are. I'm not really
That's what
actively.
So what are they?
I'm not actively in the field. A lot of it really is the curriculum. And I think there can be things like we sort of got away from phonics and spelling in really basic education. It really is important.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just live on sight words. For some kids, they really thrive with that, but that's, you have to make sure that you're using all of the methodologies that lead to successful kids.
Love it. And Seaside did do really well under your watch. I do want to give you some praise because, and you can explain even more, but I mean, you've had very great high graduation rates. I mean, you've just had a really successful programs. I mean, in bringing Cannon Beach to a close, and I mean, you had lots of changes. How did you handle all of that before handing off all of it as well?
It was hard. I mean, it was time for me to go. And Susan Penrod, it was a great, person to take over. And she's the one that had to deal with COVID. And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing with, you know, not just Seaside or I think it's nationwide. There's still just a lot of kids who have not recovered from that.
Let's talk a little bit about making that transition from being a teacher in the classroom to administration.
My principal at Broadway Middle School came to me one day and said, we like to really consider people in the district, and I think you should consider being an administrator, which I said, no. And he says, well, just take the first class and see what you think. And it's kind of like my first moment in teaching. When I got through that first course, I think that is what I want to do. And as much as I love teaching, I will say that the real joyful work for me was being a school principal. Loved every minute of it.
And who was that person, that principal that said
Jim White.
Okay.
Do you know Jim White?
I don't.
He was at Earhart and Broadway and here for a long time.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah.
So in your free time now, you still fill it with lots of activities, including one major pastime.
Right. I am the one of the head coaches for North Coast Paddling Club, and we are Astoria's dragon boating team.
Yay!
And my friend and colleague, Sandy Brown, and I started the team after commuting from here to Nehalem for 11 years, 3 days a week to be on a dragon boat. And we decided we better start our own team. And we hoped we'd get 20 people to fill a boat. We just finished our second season. We have about 65 people on our roster. We own two boats now. Due to the generosity of one of our local businesses, Lum's Auto, which was wonderful. And we were able to take out 44 people at a time. And so we have some rotating people in and out, but that's just their real life. You know, they work on Wednesdays or whatever. So it's just about the right number of people. And this year, which was our second year of competition, we took a silver medal in the Portland International Dragon Boat Festival. And there's a number of divisions. You know, we weren't the elite division, but everybody came home with a silver medal. And
where do you amazing. Where do you practice?
Out on the John Day River.
Not so fun. By Skip's old house.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah, that out on the main street in the Columbia is a little too rough.
Yeah, I bet. Well, thank you so much, Sheila. I appreciate all that you've done, all that you've done for our community and for raising generations of children and young adults and empowering them with the gift of education. Thank you.
And we
thank
have
you.
No doubt you've made a difference in inspiring people.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Go Make Some History, and we will catch you next week.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.